I know Steve is getting married tonight.
Yeah.
So let's take a look first on Daf Chav Vav Amid Aleph. And I want to give a short review of what we did last time and segue into tonight's Shia.
It's all about the Shofarot.
What do you say?
It's all about the Shofarot.
Correct. And the shofar is kosher from every single animal that's kosher, with the exception of the parah. And the reason for that, the Gemara offers two explanations. One explanation is because Ein Kateger Nasa Sanegar, which means that the parah reminds us of the Cheta Egel, so that we can't bring on Rosh Hashanah, we can't blow on Rosh Hashanah. And the other is because the shofar of a parah looks a little bit different. It's called gildy-gildy, meaning it has sort of like sections to it, you know, it's divided up. So it looks like more than one shofar. So we're going to focus our attention, how are you, Binyam? We're going to focus our attention on the first explanation that we gave, and that's called Ein Kateger Nasa Sanegar, because the parah reminds us of the Cheta Egel. So the Gemara asks, what's the source for this halacha, this principle called Ein Kateger Nasa Sanegar? And the Gemara says, it's the fact that the Torah says that when the Kohen Gadol does the avoda on Yom HaKippur, and he goes lifnim, he wears Big Day Lavan, and he takes off his Big Day Zahav. And the reason for that is because the Zahav reminds us again of the Cheta Egel. So the Gemara asks, but what about all the avodas that he does outside the Kodesh Kodashim? There he's wearing the golden garments. Why don't we apply the principle of Ein Kateger Nasa Neger? The Gemara says that Ein Kateger only applies Lifnai V'Lifnim, in the Kodesh Kodashim. But all the avodas he does outside the Kodesh Kodashim he can do even in Big Day Zav, and that's not a problem. So Gemara asks, well, you want to apply this principle to shofar, and you want to say that the reason why we can't use the shofar of a parah is because Ein Kateger, the shofar is blown all over the world, it's not blown in the Kodesh Kodashim. So the Gemara answers that the shofar came into Lizikron Kai, that since the shofar comes Lizikaron, it means to bring our memory, to bring, so to speak, Klal Yisrael in front of the Ribbono Shel Olam, that Hashem should see us and think of us and remember us. Therefore, it's Kilifnai V'Lifnimdom. It's as if the shofar is being blown inside the Kodesh Kadosh. So that was a summary of what we did last time. Now for tonight, I want to do two more pieces, and maybe we'll fit this all into a puzzle. One piece is here on Daf Chav Vav Amid Beis, and you'll see that the Mishnah and the Sugya and the Gemara on the bottom of the page on Chav Vav Amid Beis addresses the issue of what the shofar should look like. And there are two possibilities. One is Pashut, like for example the Yael. The Yael is an animal that has a shofar, its horn is straight. And the other is the shofar that's Kafuf. Kafuf means it's bent over, and that's the shofar of an Yael, of a ram. And the Gemara has two opinions which shofar we should use. This machlokas, by the way, in the Gemara is relevant not only to Rosh Hashanah, it's also relevant to the Yovel, because if the 50th year comes along on Yom Kippur, they blew the shofar. Once again, there's going to be a machlokas whether or not you use a Yael Pashut or you should use an Ayal Kofuf. Those are the two possibilities. Okay. So the Gemara tries to explain what lies at the heart of this machlokas. But Maiko Miflegi. Why? Now let's just go over the names. See, Levi is the one who says that the shofar of both Rosh Hashanah and Yom HaKippurim should be kafuf, it should be bent over, like the ram's horn. And the Chachamim say no. The Chachamim say that the shofar should be posh, it should be straight, like that of an ayal. So the Gemara asks, b'maika miflegi. And if you're counting up from the bottom of the page, it's about five lines up before the end of the Amud, if you have that, on Daf Chav Vav Amid Beis. You have it, b'maika miflegi. So first we'll just read the Gemara, and then we'll try to explain it according to Rashi. Mar Savar, according to one opinion, b'Rosh Hashanah, Kama de Kayif, Kayif means to be bent over, like the word Kofuf. Kayif inish daite, Tfei Mali. Tfei Mali means it's better. So it's better that a person on Rosh Hashanah should be bent over, so to speak. His mindset should be one of subservience, one of humility. That's according to one opinion. And then the Gemara says, Umar Sovar, that's two lines up from the bottom, but Rosh Hashanah kamed de poshet in ish taitei tvei maile. It's better if his mindset is straight, and therefore take a shofar that's straight. So what's this all about? Obviously we're dealing with two issues. Number one, what should be the mindset of a person when he blows the shofar, he hears the shofar Rosh Hashanah? Should it be kafuf, bent down, or should it be straight? All this is very enigmatic. And secondly, as a result of this machlokas, we want to know what the shofar itself should look like. So the attitude of the person, his mindset, should be reflective or reflected in the tzura, in the shape of the shofar. If you prefer that his mindset be straight, then the shofar should be straight. If his mindset should be bent, then the shofar should be bent. Okay. So let's look at Rashi. Rashi says the following. Kama de Kayif Inish, which is about 10 lines up from the bottom, a little bit more maybe. Kama de Kayif Inish. Rashi says, Bitfiloso, let's look at the posture of a person when he davens. And it's kofuf, a person is bent over. Panav kvushiv la'aretz, his face is turned towards the ground. Tvei adif, and that's preferable. Mishu. Why do we say such a thing? When a person prays, he should bend himself down. So he quotes a pasuk in Malachim. It says, "V'hayu eini v'libi sham, eini v'libi sham." That my eyes and my heart should be turned inwardly, sham, there towards the ground. Hilkach. Now these are the key words that I want to call to your attention. Barash Hashanah. Because so far Rashi is talking about a general halach in tefillah, that in tefillah we prefer a bent over position, and that's the attitude that's appropriate. But on Rosh Hashanah, why do we prefer that the person should have the same kind of an attitude when he hears the shofar, he should bend down? Says Rashi, "Dilat tefillah ulahazkir akedus Yitzhak ba." That the purpose of the shofar is for tefillah, for prayer, and also to remind Hashem of Akedas Yitzchak. Therefore, Be'inon, we require kfufin, and you should be bent over. So that explains one mandiyomar, that since in tefillah, a person should be bowed down, and that's based on a pasuk v'hoya eini v'libi sham, so too, in shofar, a person should have that attitude of being bowed down, bent over. And the shofar itself should reflect that posture, that position.
Humbleness.
A kind of a humility.
Humility.
And then if you take a look at the next Rashi, explaining the Tanakhama, Kama de Poshet Tvei Adif, it's better that he be straight, Mishum, and Rashi quotes a pasuk in Eicha, Nisa Levavenu El Kapayim, which means that a person sort of puts out his hands like this, and that's in a straight position. Hilkach Barash Hashanah, so too in Rosh Hashanah when we get to the shofar. Bipshutim, we would like a simple, straight shofar. Why? Dilat tefillah. Because it comes for the purpose of tefillah. Now what's common to both opinions?
That they say that it has to be reflected like the way we daven,
our
posture during
daven. Excellent. That the shofar and the attitude we have when we hear, the state of mind that we're in when we hear the shofar, should be reflective of tefillah. And that Rashi repeats twice. Once when he says kafuf, that you should be bent over. And the second time when he talks about poshut. In the first case he quotes a pasuk in tefillah that a person should be kafuf and he bends down looking at the ground. In the second case Rashi quotes a different pasuk in Sefer Eicha, and there a person's attitude and his posture during tefillah should be straight. And shofar likewise. Now, obviously, Rashi sees a tremendous connection here between two mitzvahs, that you and I might have said are two separate mitzvahs. Which are those two? Shofar and tefillah. Fine. Now I want to take a look at another Gemara. Again, I'm trying to piece together many pieces of the puzzle here. And that's on Daf Chav Ches Omen Aleph. Yeah, 28a, if you can. And we're going to look at a Gemara here, which is about 7-8 lines up from the bottom. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 lines up from the bottom. Shalchulei Liavud de Shmuel, a message, a halacha was sent to the father of Shmuel. Kafu lechol matz v'yochol matzah, if he was forced to eat the matzah on the night of Pesach, has he fulfilled his mitzvah? Yotza. The Gemara goes through a whole bunch of different possibilities as to exactly who is forcing him. But the bottom line is, he didn't eat matzah out of his own free will. He was coerced to eat matzah. And he's yotza. Amar Rav Ashi, Shekafu Parsiim, the non-Jews forced him and they compelled him to eat matzah at gunpoint. Maybe, Binyamin, if you don't mind, just closing that door. Now, what is this discussion about matzah, where a person was forced to eat matzah, what does that have to do with shofar? Amar Rava, three lines up from the bottom, Zoso Meris, I want to derive a conclusion from this. Hatokel is sheer yotza. If a person blows the shofar for the sake of its musical content, he's not in the least bit interested in hearing a tekiah and a shvarim and a truah and a tekiah and be yotze the mitzvah of truah. He's yotze. He fulfills his mitzvah. Which really means that he doesn't need kavanah, he doesn't have to have intention for the purpose of the mitzvah. That we saw already in Avud Shmuel, because Avud Shmuel said that if a person was coerced to eat the matzah, he was yotze, even though he didn't have kavanah. So this is a principle called mitzvos ein tzrichos kavanah. So the Gemara says, Pshita Hainuhach. Why did I need Rava to derive this conclusion and to apply the principle of mitzvahs enom tzrichas kavana from matzah over to shofar? I mean, he'd go through every single mitzvah in the Torah, you know, 248 mitzvahs, and in each case he could tell me if he was forced to do so or he did it for his own purposes, then he's yotze, because mitzvahs enom tzrichas kavana. I didn't need Rava to do that. That's what I was asking. Why did we need Rava? Apparently Rava was Machadish Achidish that I wouldn't have known. A new halacha in Shofar. And now what the Gemara is going to embark upon is a Havamina that maybe we could suggest that even if in general mitzvahs ain't Tzrichas Kavana, but when it comes to Shofar, maybe everybody would agree that mitzvahs Tzrichas Kavana. Mild, the same I might have thought, Hassam, in the case of matzah, Echol matzah, Omar Achmon. The Torah commanded me to eat matzah, V'yochal, V'ochal. Again, not because he was motivated for the mitzvah, but nevertheless he did the physical act of eating the matzah. Now we turn to the next piece of Gemara. And the Gemara says the following. Here on Daf Chof Chesam Beis. Aval Hacha, here in the case of Shofar, the Torah says, Zichron Truaksiv. And what does Zichron mean? Memory. A mental, what?
Memory,
thinking, a mental state of some sort. It's not enough to do the physical maisa of hearing the shofar, or blowing the shofar, but you have to think about something. It's Lezikaron, the Torah calls it Yom Zichron Truah.
So the actual blowing is just a means, or it's like a cleat?
Excellent. So it comes out that blowing the shofar is not really the mitzvah. The mitzvah is the zichron. It's the shofar has to trigger off something in your mind. Yeah.
So going further, it's even just hearing, it's not in itself a mitzvah.
Correct.
So people who you can argue are coerced to hearing it, or just happen to hear it, so not fulfilling the mitzvah.
Excellent. And certainly a guy who hears it because he loves the music, you know, it's reverie for him to wake up in the morning, I don't know what. I was always thinking for people oversleep, you know, I should go around with the shofar. That'd be interesting way. I once learned in yeshiva where they had this big burly guy who would come around banging on the doors with a stick. And basically when you saw the stick, you knew he was going to bang on the door, but you weren't always sure. He might have banged on a more dangerous place. So b'kitzer, a person is hearing the shofar for any number of reasons. In this case, he thinks it's Bach or Beethoven, and he's enjoying the pleasure of the shofar. Again, I would have chosen a different musical instrument, but that's what he had. He had a shofar. And is he yotze or not? So Rava says he's yotze. Why? It's no different than forcing a person to eat matzah. Says the Gemara, if not for Rava, I would have made a fundamental distinction between matzah on the one hand and shofar on the other. In matzah, I don't need kavana, because matzah is a whole matzah on Rachmana. The Torah never indicates that you have to be in a tremendous mental state, a profound meditative state, in order to fulfill matzah. It's the mechanical act of chewing and swallowing the matzah, and that he did. So there I don't need kavana. But maybe in the case of shofar, I do need kavana. Because how does the Torah describe the bits of shofar? Zichron trua. All the blowing and all the noise and the sounds is all just to get me to a state of being. Let's call it an emotional state of being called zichron trua. And again, we could stand here and give hours and hours of drushes about what we should be thinking when we hear the shofar. And every darshan is going to give you a slightly different chidush about what you should be thinking of. I think Rav Sajigon has 10 different kavanas that you should have in mind when you hear shofar. It's one of the most complicated mitzvahs. And therefore I need Rav to tell me that he's yotzei. But I want to focus your attention on the Havamina. The Gemara in the Havamina thought that even though in matzah, if you're forced to eat matzah, you're certainly not motivated by the mitzvah, you're yotzei, but not in the case of shofar. On. So just to summarize, we have the following. We have the fact that we, as we said last week and reviewed it at the beginning of tonight's shiur, a shofar of a para is possible because ein kateger nasenig. We have the Gemara on Daf Chaf Amud Beis, a machlokes as to what the shofar should look like. Should it be straight or should it be bent over? And that has to reflect the proper attitude, says Rashi, for tefillah. Then we had the Gemara about kavana. Do you have to have a certain kavana in mind? Or is it just the mechanical act of hearing the shofar? And the Gemara says that if not for Rava, I would have assumed that since the Torah describes this mitzvah as zichron trua, therefore the mental state is absolutely critical. That's the essence of the mitzvah. And in a case where you were just listening to the shofar or blowing the shofar for musical purposes, you would certainly not be yotzei. Even though in matzah, the parallel case, you would fulfill your obligation, but not in the case of shofar. These are the pieces of the puzzle that I want to put together. So I have an essay here that I want to go through with you. I think it's a very profound essay. And I photocopied it for you. So I was very optimistic. I made 4 copies. Okay, well, Max is at a wedding tonight. I'm not sure where Rabbi Goldfisher is. He should be here. But if you can take one of these pages, we'll have an extra set just in case. So we'll put one set over here. And this is the second half of the handout. I didn't find stapler I couldn't find, so I apologize, I didn't staple them together. And you'll see that the title of the article is Be'inyan Mitzvahs Mitzvah B'Shofar Kofuf, and this comes from a sefer called Hare Kedem. Have you ever heard of Hare Kedem? Okay, so let me just give you a little background here, who the Hare Kedem is. You know, I live in a neighborhood called Har Nof. And one of the great rabbis that lives in Har Nof, besides our friend from South Africa, the great rabbi, is Rabbi Michal Shurkin. So you have Rav Sternbach on the one side of the street and Rabbi Shurkin on the other side of the street. They're very close buddies, by the way.
Shurkin from South Africa as well?
No. Only Rav Sternbach is from South Africa.
From England.
England. Oh, I thought he was from South Africa. My mistake. Wasn't he for a long time in South Africa?
He was in South Africa.
Yeah. So I wasn't so far off. Then. Anyway, it's all English Commonwealth, right, Joel? Yeah? All right. But it's not just. Give him a copy if you can. So I see I was optimistic, Baruch Hashem. Rav Shurkin was a student of Rabbi Soloveitchik. That's where I studied. But I only studied for 5 years, whereas he studied for 18 years. He used to sit in the back. 18 years. Kamiyan Chai. And everybody knew that he was the scholar of the Shia, even though we had some very brilliant people in the Shia. You had, I don't know if you ever heard of these names, Menachem Knack. and Menachem Schrader, and
Rabbi Schrader, who's
was in Hamiftar. Cool. Yeah, he was in my class. Rabbi Ilson, if you ever heard of him. Rabbi Alpert used to come whenever he could. All the Shalom Rav Shechter used to come whenever he could. There were quite a few scholars there. Rabbi Rosenzweig, who's been a Rebbe in YU for the last, I don't know, 30 years. He is the disciple of Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. And we were all sitting around, but there was Rav Shurkin in the back. He was very quiet. He very rarely had anything to say. He wrote notes. I used to pass by and watch him the way he wrote notes. He had a very interesting flair to the way he held the pen. And from time to time, when he had something to say, all he needed to do was go like this and put one foot on his chair. And then the Rav was looking right at him. There were 100 other people in the room, but the Rav was looking right at him. And the Rav knew exactly that he had something to say. Now, his daughter married a rabbi from Har Nof called Rav Auerbach, whose father is the chief rabbi in Tveria, whose grandfather was Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. And this Rav Auerbach is an outstanding Talmid Chacham. And he took it upon himself, based on the notes that Rav Shurkin took for 18 years, to write Sfarim. So what you're looking at, the Hari Kedem, these are a few pages of a 5-volume work on many different sugyas and shas. And if Rabbi Shurkin will work with his son-in-law, Rabbi Auerbach, for the next 50 years, there'll be another 50 volumes because of all the notes that he took over the course of 18 years. So in this Sefer, he has a few pieces on Rosh Hashanah, and this piece caught my eye. I even wrote notes on it of my own. You'll see that in the chicken scratch on the bottom. And he starts by quoting the Rambam. You know that our minog is like that Mandiyama, which is Levi, who says that the shofar that we blow is what? Kofuf, it's bet. The Rambam says, Perek Aleph Milchus Shofar Aloch Aleph, is shofar shetokim bein b'Rosh Hashanah ubein b'Yovel, hu keren hakvasim hakofuf. It's the horn of sheep or ram that's bent over. And the Ravik says the following: Omar Avram hifriz al midosim. He went too far. El mitzvah bekvufim. It's a very nice idea, and it certainly embellishes if you have a bent over shofar. But if you talk about Shel Ya'el, if you use the Ya'el that has a straight shofar, Yotza. The Ayin Shom Barav HaMagid, right, the super commentary on the Rambam is the Magid Mishnah, and he writes, the Das HaRambam, the Kofuf Mi'akiv B'di'evet, that according to the Rambam, if you don't take a bent over shofar, rather a straight shofar of a Ya'el, you're not Yotza the mitzvah. Kofuf is essential to the mitzvah. It's got to be bent over. It's got to be the shofar of an ayel. The Rambam disagrees. The Rambam would agree with the Rambam that if all things are equal, the best shofar to take is a bent shofar. But you can be yotzei with the shofar pashut as well.
The Magid Mishnah is the Beit Yosef or somewhere else?
The Magid Mishnah was way before the Beit Yosef. Probably.
There's another one. There's the Beit Yosef on the Rambam.
Oh, yeah, that's the Kesef Mishnah. Yeah, I think it's Kesef Mishnah. And they all took upon themselves to write a commentary on the Rambam. They called themselves Mishnah because the Rambam is called the Mishnah Torah. So a commentary on the Mishnah is the Mishnah. Lamelech, that was Rav Rosas. He was a Spanish Jew from four centuries ago. And the Kesef Mishnah was of Yosef Cairo from Egypt. He was 5 centuries ago. The Magid Mishnah was actually an Ashkenazic Jew. And all these Mishnahs wrote commentaries on the Rambam. So the Magid Mishnah points out,
he says
Makif. Now, why do we take a shofar kofuf on Rosh Hashanah? So that's the next paragraph. And he quotes the Gemara on Chavav that we just did. Machlokas Tanoim, whether or not we prefer a shofar pashut or a shofar kofuf. And the Gemara explains to my Kov Miflugi, what are they arguing about? And Rashi embellishes the argument. He says that according to the Mandiyomer, who requires Poshut is Kama, who requires Kofuf is Kama the Kayef Inshi, Bitfiloso. When a person is standing in Tfilah, he should be bent over, turning towards the ground. And on Shofar, which is Litfilah, we also want to have a corresponding posture. Then Rashi goes on to say that according to the Mandiyomer, Poshut Tfeyodif, it's better to have a flat Shofar, a straight Shofar. And Rashi again quotes a Pasuk in Tfilah, And he says that Rosh Hashanah is also l'tfilah and therefore b'pshuta. So Rashi is quite clear that this relationship, as we pointed out before, between shofar and tefillah, and the laws of tefillah are going to be reflected in the laws of shofar. You can even go as far as to say that the laws of shofar are contingent upon the laws of tefillah, meaning the source is tefillah, and the nilmad, which is derived from tefillah, is going to be shofar. And Rav Soloveitchik here is quoted as saying that Rashi has in mind a sugya in Masechet Yevamos. The Gemara there presents a machlokes, what is the proper posture and attitude during tefillah? And according to one man, the Omer in the Gemara, HaMispalil Tzorch Yitein Einov Lemata, he should put his eyes towards the ground. As Brian said very, very well, it's a humility, it's a kind of humility, a state of humility. And he quotes the Pasuk, V'yu Einai V'libi Sham, exactly the Pasuk that Rashi quoted here in Rosh Hashanah. The other man, the Omer, says, no, HaMispalil Tzorch Yitein Einov Lemala, he should turn towards Shamayim. And the Gemara says that's based on the Pasuk Nisol of Avenu El Kapayim. So what your attitude towards tefillah is depend upon these two psukim, and that's a machlokas in the Gemara Yevamos. Rashi is taking that machlokas about what's the proper attitude towards tefillah, and he's applying it, he's sort of grafting it onto shofar. Umemela, since shofar depends upon tefillah, then you can have two opinions in shofar, just like you have two opinions in tefillah. According to the opinion in tefillah that your eyes should be kfufim, should be turned towards the bottom, the shofar should be kfuf. And if you hold that the attitude in tefillah should be his eyes are up towards shamayim, then pshutim are on. And all this seems to indicate that clearly Rashi has a kind of an equation here between tefillah and shofar. Now this is very fascinating to me, because I'll tell you why. We have two categories of shofar. Does anybody know the two different fundamental categories of shofar? Or let me give you a hint, when you blow the shofar? No, on Rosh Hashanah. I'm saying we can break down shofar of Rosh Hashanah to two basic component parts. Excellent, beautiful Binyamin. Miyushav is blown when?
Before
Musaf. Excellent, before Musaf. And Ma'umad is blown during the Musaf. And ask yourself the following question. I'm in the middle of Musaf. I'll give you an example on Sukkot. Sukkot morning, I'm davening Musaf. Anybody here want to tell me where they daven on Musaf on Sukkot morning? Like, what, Joel?
Sorry, what's the question? Sure.
Where do you daven on Sukkot morning, Musaf? Chakras and Musaf. Where? Here in the ELC? You don't want to tell me. It's a top secret. Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
I'm not sure, not physically.
You know, maybe you're in England. Maybe you're in England on
Sydney.
On Sukkot. You'll be in Sydney. The Heschel's in Sydney, right?
Yeah.
Just kidding. My brother-in-law, his best friend was a rabbi in Sydney. His name is Rabbi Apple. I don't know if you ever heard of him.
Yeah. He writes in the Torah
Tzitzis everywhere. Oh, that makes him very famous. But his real time to fame is that he was my brother-in-law's good buddy. Anyway, so what I want to tell you is that just imagine if you can close your eyes and see yourself in Sydney or wherever you like to be in Musaf, on Sukkot, and in the middle of Musaf, you take the lulav and you start shaking. What would you say to such a person?
You're not at the right time. You're not
at
the right thing.
Not only that, it would be what? Anyone know what the word would be if it's appropriate when you do something in the middle of davening? It's called a hefsek. Excellent, a hefsek. Wonderful. And let's say if on the night of the night of Pesach, again, you have to imagine where you'll be. But you know you're going to be again in Australia?
No.
You're here locally? In some Sephardic shul? Okay. And you're in the middle of Shmoneh Esrei on the night of Pesach, and you decide to eat matzah. What would you say about that? Be a hefsek. Now I'm going to ask you the following. What if I'm davening Musaf on Rosh Hashanah? In the middle of the Musaf service, I hear the shofar. What would you say about that?
Hefsek.
It should be a hefsek. Yeah. This is what we do. This is called Tkiyas de Ma'uman. This is the way Chazal established it.
And also, you know, some people do it in the mashin. I don't think I've been to many, but some people in mashin.
Sure. That was my father's minute. That we actually blow the shofar in the middle of the stillish moment. Yeah. The silence.
Some frying goes well.
Yeah, a lot of Sfarim do it. And it's the right way, by the way. But even if you don't have that minhag, you blow the shofar during the Chazaras HaShatz, that's also a hefsek. We don't take a lulav in the middle of the Chazaras HaShatz. We don't eat bats in the middle of Chazaras HaShatz. It would be a hefsek. So my high. Now what's the answer?
That it's
Rashi's equation, namely what?
It's tefillah.
Exactly. That shofar equals tefillah. Shofar equals tefillah. Number one, that just like in shofar and tefillah have an attitude of any v'libi sham of kafuf, the shofar also has to be kafuf. And when I hear the shofar, my attitude has to be kafuf. Number two, the Gemara thinks that if somebody would blow the shofar for musical enjoyment, he's not yotzei the mitzvah. Why? If I'm forced to eat matzah, I'm yotzei the mitzvah, but in shofar, if I don't have a mental state, and I don't feel something, then I'm not yotzei. I'm just interested in the musical element. That's not enough. Why? Because it says Zichron true. What does Zichron mean now, according to Rashi? Tefillah. In Tefillah, there's no such thing as Tefillah without Kavana. Tefillah without Kavana is Kiguf Beli Neshama. It's like a body without a soul. It's dead. So we begin to weave together the following elements. Blowing the shofar in the middle of Shmona Esrei, in the case of Musaf, which is called Kios de Ma'umad, is not a foreign element to tefillah. On the contrary, it integrates very well. It's what we call min bimino. Are you familiar with that phrase? It's two things that belong to the same type, the same ilk. They're woven together to form one entity. It's not that I'm introducing a foreign element. Matzah has nothing to do with tefillah. And lulav has nothing to do with tefillah. But shofar has to do with tefillah. And he says the following, the Rambam paskins that we need a shofar kafuf. And it's ma'akev. You're not yotze the mitzvah, says the Rambam, with a shofar poshut. Why? Because the Rambam takes this equation between shofar and tefillah to its ultimate extreme, to its the end result. And if shofar equals tefillah, then we have to have a shofar that reflects the attitude and the posture that's appropriate for tefillah. It's got to be kafuf. That's the Rambam's psak. But we have a problem. Because the Gemara says at the end of the day, Amar Rav Zosomeres, Hatokel Shir Yotze, that if he blows the shofar for the sake of musical enjoyment, he is Yotze the Mitzvah. Meaning that Rava does apply at the end of the day the principle of mitzvah srichas kavana, or mitzvah ein srichas kavana, to shofar. So here we have a blowing the shofar without kavana, without intention. You cannot call it tefillah. Tefillah without kavana is tiguf b'li neshama. And yet in the case of shofar, halacha l'maisa, if he heard the shofar for the sake of musical enjoyment, he's yotze. That's the final maskana. The Mal of the same was, since it says Zichron Trua, I would think that he has to have a mental state. And just hearing the shofar would not be enough. Kamashman Robert tells me that I never would have thought of, that I could be Yotzi the shofar, even if my intention is only for the sake of musical instrument Tokel Shir. So Rav Soloveitchik now says we're in a bind. Because the Rambam says that this equation between tefillah and shofar is likuva. It defines the very essence of the shofar. A shofar has to be kafuf, and if it's not bent over, if it's straight, you're not yotzei the mitzvah of shofar, because it doesn't reflect and image the posture that's appropriate for tefillah. So the equation between shofar and tefillah is absolutely essential. And then we're saying that atokei l'shir yotzeh. So here we're up to the paragraph that starts Hamavur Mizin. He says the following. He's got a Mishnah in Masechta Sukkah with regard to the lulav. The Mishnah establishes that the minimum size of a lulav has to be 4 tefachim, even though the Arabos and the Hadassim only have to be 3 tefachim. So the Mishnah asks the question, why is it in lulav we need the extra tefach? And the Mishnah answers, because of nanuim, that the lulav should tower above the other two minim for nanuim. Now, the law is that if you have a lulav that's 3.999 tefachim, but it's not 4 tefachim, it's pasul d'oraisa, and you're not yotzei the mitzvah. Why? So the Mishnah says you need that extra tefach, which you don't have. He got most of the extra teva, but not all of it. For the mitzvah of Natnuim. Yeah, but the Gemara has a principle in lulav, mida'ad bein nafik bein, which means as soon as you pick up the lulav, you yotze the mitzvah. And if you omitted Natnuim, which you shouldn't have done, but you should have done Natnuim, but you didn't do Natnuim.
It's not
ma'ake. So now we're in a bind. Because you're telling me that the shear of the lulav has to be a minimum of what? Four tefachim. And why the fourth tefach? For Nanuim. And yet you're telling me that I can be yotzei the mitzvah without Nanuim. So Rav Soloveitchik says the following. We see something absolutely fundamental in terms of the operation of halacha. The way halacha operates is that the mitzvah, the object of the mitzvah, has to lend itself to the full-fledged mitzvah. To the ideal kiyum mitzvah, the ideal kiyum mitzvah of lulav is not mid'ad be nothing; they're just simply lifting it. But what? Nanuim. Now the cheftza, the object with which I fulfill this mitzvah, namely the lulav, has to be roi. It has to be suitable for the full fledged mitzvah. The full fledged mitzvah includes what? Nanuim, and therefore I need how many tefachim?
Four.
We need a fourth tefach. Ah, if that be the case, the halacha is as follows. As far as what I have to do, I have to pick up the lulav. And although I should be adding Nanuim, but Nanuim is not critical. I could be yotzei my mitzvah, fulfill my obligation with picking up the lulav without Nanuim, but the object itself to qualify as a lulav has to be roi, it has to have the potential and suitable for the full-fledged mitzvah, which I have to do with Nanuim. If that be the case, let's apply it to shofar. In the ideal mitzvah of shofar, what should he have in mind? Tefillah. But lemaisa, if he had in mind music, l'shem shir, he would be yotzei. But the perfect mitzvah would be a tefillah dika mitzvah. The nafkamina is the shofar itself. The Rambam says the shofar has to reflect the ideal mitzvah. What's the ideal mitzvah? Tefillah. What's the right posture for tefillah? Kofof. And therefore the shofar has to be kofof. So I wanted to suggest that maybe this could explain a Gemara in Shabbos. And I wrote it here on the left side. The Gemara says in Masechta Shabbos that when you fill up the candle with oil for Chanukah, it's got to be roi. It has to have enough oil that it can last for a full half hour. That's called Mishkiyas Achama Shetichla Regel Minashuk. Then the Gemara has a machlokas. What happens if the candle goes out, kofsa, even after I just lit it? And we passing like that, my dear, says kofsa ein zokakla, that he was yotzei the mitzvah, he doesn't have to rekindle the light. Now we have the same question. You're telling me that I have to put it in oil in order to last for a half hour. And if I don't have enough oil to last for a half hour, then it's not an Erech Chanukah and I'm not yotzei. But then you're turning around and telling me Kof Sein Zocher Klug, which means it doesn't have to be lit for a half hour.
It has a potential.
Exactly. The cheft of the mitzvah, the object of the mitzvah, has to have the potential for the ideal mitzvah. The ideal mitzvah would not be kof so that it blows out. That happened. I can't control
it. You've done it.
With this, I want to answer a kasha that I had about matzah. The Gemara says, Bola matzah yotzah. If you swallow the matzah without chewing it, means, let's say you open your mouth wide, hopefully you won't choke yourself to death, but you put the matzah down your throat, without tasting it, you yotzah. Then the Gemara says, that if you take matzah and you cook it in water, you're not yotzah with that matzah. And this is a very complicated issue for people who are elderly and they can't chew. We'd like to cook the matzah, make it soft, but we can't do that. We have to find another solution to the problem. Why? Because matzah mevusheles is not matzah because it doesn't have tam matzah. Now, I don't understand. You just finished telling me bola matzah yotzah. If I swallow the matzah without tasting it, by shoving it down my throat, then I didn't chew it, I didn't taste it, nothing, but it. I'm yotzah the mitzvah. So you see that tam matzah is not critical. And yet you're telling me that when I cook the matzah, I can't be yotzei because it has no tam matzah. What's the answer of Osai?
Yeah, the ideal is that
the heft of the mitzvah, I want you to say it the way I want you to say it. Yeah. The heft of the mitzvah has to be roi for the ideal mitzvah, the full-fledged kima mitzvah. And the full-fledged kima mitzvah, we require tasting the matzah. Don't start throwing it, shoving it down your throat. The maisa, as far as the gavra, as far as the maisa is concerned, you could be yotz even without tasting it. But the matzah has to be roi for tasting. And with this explanation, perhaps we can answer a fundamental question which Tosfos raises at the beginning of Lulav HaGozel. You know, I'm teaching in the morning Lulav HaGozel, and the Mishnah says that if a lulav gets dried up, you're not yotze. It's called a lulav hayobesh. So Rashi says, why aren't you yotze? Because the pasuk says in Parashas Beshalach, ze keli v'anveinu, which means I have to be mahadar the mitzvah. And to be a hide of the mitzvah, I have to take a moist lulav that still has some lachluchas in it. I can't take a dried up lulav. So Tosfos says, Zeh Kelim Aveh is a very nice idea, but it's never likuva. For example, the Gemara says it would be very nice to bind your lulav together with the haravas and hadasim, but if you didn't bind your lulav and you had three minim, you know, first you have the esrog and you have the other three minim on the table, you took them one after the other, you're yotzei. So the Gemara says that even though lulav would be embellished if you had the agad, if you bound it together, but nevertheless binding it together is not likuva. You see that zeh keli aveihu is nice, and it certainly embellishes the mitzvah, but it's not likuva. So how could Rashi quote the pasuk zeh keli aveihu as an explanation why the Mishnah says lulav hayovesh is possible? But the answer is as follows: the lulav has to lend itself potentially for Zekeli Yavim. Once it becomes dried up, there's no element of Zekeli Yavim. Lamaisa, as far as the Maisa Gavra, the fulfillment of the mitzvah, I don't need Zekeli Yavim. I could be Yotze even if it's not Zekeli. I can take the most simple lulav in the world. But it has to be royal with Zekeli Yavim. It has to have some element of Zekeli Yavim. Now I want you to fast forward for a moment to the third page, which you'll see on the top left, it'll say Tezvav on it. And then we'll try to fill in the middle part. But I want to go according to my order, not according to the order of the Harikin. If you can find a paragraph, a section, it's called number Dalin, on page Tezvav, on the left column, the left side, and it starts with the heading Bir Ma'amoram Kevan de Lezichon Hu Kilbifnim Dome. You remember that the Mishnah tells us that a shofar that's made of a para is possible. And the Gemara says, why? Because Ein Kategar Nasidik. The Gemara says, wait a minute, the Kohen is not wearing Big Day Zav. He does all the avoda outside the kachim in Big Day Zav. What about Ein Kategor Nasaneg? The Gemara says that Ein Kategor Nasaneg only applies where? Lifnai v'lifnim in the Kodesh Kadoshim. Frech the Gemara, if that be the case, how can you tell me that the shofar of a para is possible because of Ein Kategor Nasaneg? That's not Lifnai v'lifnim, it's not in the Kodesh Kadoshim. The Gemara answers, Keva de Lezichron Kai. So Rav Soloveitchik asks the following question: what does it mean that blowing the shofar is like standing lefnai v'lefnim? And his answer is the following. And this you'll see in a paragraph that starts v'nira lefarish, all the way at the bottom of the page. He says, the Rambam tells us in Perek Dalet, Milchus Tefillah, that kavana is one of the five elements of tefillah that's absolutely indispensable. It's critical. And then the Rambam goes on to ask, and kesad hiya kavana, what is kavana? So the Rambam says he clears his mind, like we all do, right? We're not thinking about the soccer game or anything like that. Right? Or our stocks and our bonds and our investments and the tension that we have in life and our children. No, we're thinking purely about standing in front of the Shekhinah. And the Rambam says that that's what we have to do. Clear our brains. You know, when we were kids, we used to play a game called Etch-a-Sketch. Did you ever hear of it? Yeah, so you clear it out, you know, and then it becomes absolutely clean, you know. So that's what we have to do to our brains. Our brains have to become Etch-a-Sketch. And the only thing on our brain is one thing at all, that I'm standing in front of the Shekhinah. That's what the Rambam says. The Yiras Atzmo Kilu Omed Lifnei Hashchina. So what does the Rambam mean that he's Omed Lifnei Hashchina? So if you take a look in the next parak of the Rambam, in Hilchos Tefillah, the Rambam says the following. V'yia libo ponui lemala. Underline that word lemala. Lemala means towards the heavens. Kilu hu omeid v'ashamayim. You know, you could say that the Shekhinah, I'm standing in front of the Shekhinah, what should I do? You know, in a sense, I should feel a sense of humility for sure, an awesome power here. I'm standing in front of God in dialogue with God. But the Rambam says you should imagine not that God is down here in front of you, meaning I brought God down from the heavens because he wants to meet with me. I'm very chashu. But just the opposite. You have to go up to the heavens. So he says the following, L'fichach yira atzmo kilu omeid lifnei Shekhinah means bashamayim, up in shamayim. So Rav Soloveitchik wants to say the following. We've already established that according to the Rambam, there's an absolute equation between shofar and what? Tefillah. Now in tefillah, you have to be up in shamayim. So the answer is that in shofar, since it's tefillah, his kavana should be that he stands in the Kodesh Kadoshim. The Kodesh Kadoshim is that one place on earth that's like the shamayim. It's almost like you went up to the heavens. And that's why the Gemara says, "Ein kategor nasa nega." You can't use the shofar of a parah, which reminds us of the chet ha'egel, because you're standing where you blow. You think you're blowing the shofar in Sydney, Australia. No, you're not in Sydney, Australia. You're up in Shamayim, because that's where the Shekhinah is, and you go up to the Shamayim, and therefore you're required to clear your mind and be up in Shamayim. Don't take any kind of shofar that could in any way remind you of the Chet HaEgel. Not a shofar shel paro. Not a shofar that's covered with gold, because gold is also a very... because you're lifnei v'lifnei. Joel?
I'm saying something... I'm not advocating for what I'm going to say, but with all this feeling and mindset which you have, why is it not a Yom Song? It's such a powerful thing, and you're saying this connection with Shammai and everything.
I think tefillah has to be prayed b'simcha. A Yom Song is a very somber and solemn day. It's very hard to achieve simcha and be happy. When I stand in front of the Shekhinah, if I have access to the King of Kings, can you imagine if the Queen of England would call you in for a meeting? You know. So if you have no meeting, no appointment with her, so you come to the secretary, and the secretary says, what are you doing here? She says, well, I can't see the Queen. No, what's your name? My name is Joel Mack. It's not on my list. Nice to meet you, Joel, but go home. Right? And the Ribbono Shel Olam is up in Shamayim, and he says, come. I want you to have an audience with me. That experience is a simchadik experience. It's not appropriate for solemnity, for fasting. We have such great confidence in our ability to stand in front of Hashem in Shamayim that we're going to buy new clothes for Rosh Hashanah. We're going to wear white clothes if you like that minog. If you're a bretzeler, you'll wear a white yarmulke. And you'll do everything you have to do to show that you believe that Hashem is there embracing you. So that the attitude and the feelings of Rosh Hashanah are very complicated. They're very paradoxical. On the one hand, you're right. It's the Yom HaDin. It's the Day of Judgment. It's awe. We're coming in front of the Melech Malchi HaMelechim. But on the other hand, God cares for us. He wants us to blow the shofar. He's calling us in, one by one. And he's saying, coronate me as king. That is a tremendous simcha. So I would say that Rosh Hashanah is not a day of atzvus, of sadness. It's not a day of solemnity. It's a day of awesome happiness. The pasuk says, "Gilu b'ra'ada." You can integrate both gila and ra'ada. They sound like mutually exclusive. That's the paradox of Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is the most paradoxical day of the year. My Rebbe used to always tell us, I heard it from a number of times, that when he stands in front of American audiences and he tries to explain Judaism to them, he never has a problem with any of the holidays. Each holiday is connected with some sort of historical event. So he can explain Pesach, and he can explain Matan Torah and Shavuos, and he can explain what Sukkot means to us as we go through the desert and we're protected. He can explain Yom Kippur, it's the day of Kapara. But Rosh Hashanah he can't explain. As much as he tries, people do not understand Rosh Hashanah. It's beyond our comprehension. It is the most complicated, in a sense, antithetical day. There are so many theses and antitheses. It's one continuous Hegelian dialectic. And that's what Rosh Hashanah is. Very complicated, very abstract, very difficult to explain to a modern audience because they're not oriented in different, in a combination, a paradoxical weaving together of different feelings and different emotions.
Havdil, they have all New Year, but they just have best resolutions, but they're fireworks, so only have the happy. They don't understand the
right, the seriousness. I don't think they have a feeling for what the awesome and heavy duty repercussions are for Rosh Hashanah. It's going to determine so much, not only for you, but for your family, for the community, and for the whole world. But at the same time, with those tefillos in mind, we have to be besimcha. And that's the unique aspect of Rosh Hashanah. The Rambam paskens, by the way, that just like any yontiv is docha velus, so let's say somebody buried their dead before Sukkot. Sukkot comes and completely undermines Shiva. There's no Shiva. So too Rosh Hashanah undermines avelus. On the other hand, we don't say Hallel on Rosh Hashanah. We can't dance and sing Hallel because it's a very solemn day in that sense, but not a day that undermines our Simcha. And the mitzvah of Simcha applies to Rosh Hashanah. V'samachta b'chagech. Maybe it's not going to be so overt with so many jumping and thing. I don't know what happens in the Ukraine. Maybe there they do jump a lot on Rosh Hashanah. I have a fellow who comes to my shiur. He says, Rabbi, after tomorrow you won't see me for the next 18 days. I'll be in Uman. Okay. The only question I had of him, why couldn't get a ticket for me? I heard there could be 30 or 40,000 people there. That's pretty heavy. I don't like that they give all this business to the Ukrainians, but okay, fine. So now I want to add another piece to the puzzle. So let's see how many pieces we have to the puzzle, Rav Moshe. First of all, we have Rashi that the size and the shape of the shofar should be reflective of the attitude and the posture of tefillah. And Rashi says, because shofar is lit tefillah. Secondly, we have the mitzvah of blowing the shofar in the middle of Musaf Shmoneh Esrei. If it wasn't tefillah, it would be a foreign element and it would certainly be a hefsek. Thirdly, we have a havamina that you definitely need kavan in tefillah because it's a zikron kai. Fourthly, we exclude a shofar of a para because ein kategor nasanein, which is the principle that only applies to lifnai v'lifnim. And just like in tefillah, the Rambam says we're up in Shamayim, so too when we blow the shofar, we're up in Shamayim and we're in the Kodesh Kadosh in the holiest of holies. And therefore we can't take a shofar shel para and we have to get rid of all the gold and anything that might remind us of the egg. Now we get to number five. And number five is the Shita of Rashi. Rashi has a very unique Shita about what we call Malchus, Zichronos, and Shofars. And the one who sort of is the adversary, so to speak, the other contestant in this controversy is the Ramban. The Ramban has problems with this Rashi. So what I'd like you to do here in this little handout that I gave you for today is to take a look on the bottom of the first page that I gave you, which is page Yud Gimel, and going on to page Yud Dalet. On the very bottom, we have the pasuk in Parshas Emor that tells us Zichron Trua. We spoke about this pasuk before, now we see it inside. Now we're up on Daf Yud Dalet Omer Aleph on page Yud Dalet. Rashi writes in his commentary on the Torah in Parshas Emor, what does Zichron Trua mean? Rashi mentions Zichronos, Shofros. And Ramban says, I don't get it. How could Rashi on Chumash, in the Pasuk of Zichron Trua, quote these categories called Malchus and Zichronos? Chumash is a Doraisa, and the Torah advocates and mandates a mitzvah Doraisa of Shofar. the psukim that we read as far as Malchi, Zechronos, and Shofros, those are rabbinic institutions. That's an asmachta midevrayim. You can't tell me that that's what the Torah has in mind in a mitzvah d'oraisa. Rashi is crossing all the bounds here by integrating a mitzvah d'rabbanan into a pasuk in Chumash. How does the Ramban know that Malchi, Zechronos, and Shofros is only d'rabbanan? So he quotes a fascinating sugya in Rosh Hashanah. A man has two options on Rosh Hashanah. He can go to one shul or he can go to another shul. Okay, one of these days you'll tell me, Joel, what shul you daven. I don't know. I guess I didn't know I was getting personal.
No, I hesitated because I haven't actually booked my place yet.
So okay.
Officially,
but where were you last year? Let's just say.
I was here, and I hope to be here this year.
Here in the ELC.
I believe so.
Oh. So here's the deal. There's a shul called, we'll call it Nitzanim, right? And then there's another shul called the ELC. The ELC has a great Baal Tefillah who knows Malchi Zechronos Shofros. Again, 1,000 years ago, they didn't have printed Sidurim. So to know Malchi Zechronos Shofros, to know by heart, was not a simple task. And the shul down the block has a great Baal Tekiah, but they don't have any clue about Malchi Zechronos Shofros. Now you have a choice. You can't go to both shuls, because you can't afford the membership in two shuls. Which shul should you go to? So Rabbi Berzel, that's a very interesting question. How'd you think of that question? The reason I thought of that question is because the Gemara asks this question. Right? The Gemara has this suffix on Daf Lam and Daled Amud Beis. And the Gemara comes to the conclusion that Holchim L'Mokum Shetokim, that you should prefer to go to hear the shofar, and Ein Holchim, even though it means you have to forfeit Mokum, Shemavarchim, that they recite the brachos of Malchi, Zechronos, and Shofros. So the Gemara says, Pshita. Of course that's true. Hada Oraisa, Vahada Rabbana. To hear the shofar is a mitzvah d'oraisa. It's one of the few mitzvahs d'oraisa that we still have today after the Mikdash was destroyed. So let's hold on to whatever we can get. On the other hand, the mitzvah of Malchi, Zechronos, Shofros is only d'Rabbana. Here you see, says the Ramban, clearly that Malchi Zechronos Shofros is only d'rabbanan. Happy Rashi have the audacity to place that in the pasuk Zichron Trua and set it up as a mitzvah d'oraisa. He's interpreting a pasuk with a mitzvah d'oraisa. It's a rabbinic invention. That's the Ramban's approach. So it comes out, which you'll see in the next paragraph. I underline the first two lines that Shitas Rashi Nireh. It seems that Rashi holds that Malchi Zechronos Shofros is d'oraisa. But then you'll ask yourself the question, wait a minute, how could Rashi hold him Malchi, Zechronos, and Shofros is d'oraisa? The Gemara says if you have a choice between these two shuls, make sure to go to the shul where you'll hear the shofar, because that's a mitzvah d'oraisa. And if you go to the other shul where you'll hear Malchi, Zechronos, and Shofros, but you won't hear the shofar, they don't have a shofar, you'll forfeit the mitzvah d'oraisa for the sake of a mitzvah d'rabbanan. So how could Rashi say that Malchi, Zechronos, and Shofros is a d'oraisa? V'aposhut, in the next paragraph, that Rashi holds that you know when the brachas are d'oraisa, that's only when they're integrated together with the tekiah shofar. If you have both, then they integrate to form one whole unit, which is a mitzvah d'oraisa. But if, let's say, you only have the Malchi Zechronos Shofros, on its own, those tefillos could never be a mitzvah d'oraisa. They can only become a d'oraisa if they're integrated into the trua. That's called Zichron Trua. So the Zichron is the Malchi, the Zichron is the shofar, so going to Rashi, together with the Trua, they're blowing the shofar, hearing the sounds of the shofar, the total of that is one mitzvah d'oraisa. So Einachinam, Malchi, the Zichron is the Zichron to Rashi, is d'oraisa, but only in one scenario, only on one condition, that it's together with what?
Shofar.
With the shofar. So in a case where you have Malchi, the Zichron is the Zichron without a shofar, on its own, that's a d'rabban. That's what he said. So you'll see this on the bottom. He says, "Lefiza muchat et kios hein midoraisa, afilu below brachos." Right, because if you have a choice, you should go to the shul where you'll hear the tkios even without the brachos, without the malchus zechronos shofros, because then you'll fulfill a mitzvah doraisa. Rashi says that malchus zechronos shofros is also doraisa. Yeah, but that doesn't mean that shofar depends upon malchus. Shofar could stand on its own as a mitzvah unto itself on a d'oraisa level, even without Malchi Zechronos Shofros. On the other hand, Malchi Zechronos Shofros could never ever stand on its own, independent of Shofros, as a mitzvah d'oraisa. It will be a mitzvah d'rabbanan. But Rashi elevates and upgrades it to the status of a mitzvah d'oraisa insofar as it's integrated together with the shofar. So if you fast forward for a moment to a paragraph at the end of this page, Dibra Maskel Elo, on the left side, he says the following, Gufa Taiva Boy, we need to understand. What does it mean that you connect and you integrate Malchus Hakohen Shofros with the shofar? How does that integration operate? What's the mechanics? How does it form one whole unit called the Mitzvah Doraisa? V'nira Baru, he said, Kanal, the Kol Iker Shofar Hulit Fila. The only way I can justify Rashi's Shita and explain why Rashi holds that Malchus Hakohen Shofros can be integrated into the shofar as one entity of a mitzvah d'oraisa is because shofar equals tefillah. If we start with that equation, then we can begin to understand what is the tefillah that's appropriate for the shofar. How do I integrate the shofar into an act of tefillah? How do I upgrade it and place it into a framework of tefillah? So again, as I said at the outset, you could have 50 million darshanim. Each one will come up with another answer as to how you should have a tefillah in your shofar. Like, for example, the famous mashal that the Baal HaTanya gave. You know, the Baal HaTanya was the first Rebbe of Chabad. He said the following. You take a shepherd boy, and he doesn't understand how to daven. He was never taught how to daven. And he turns to the Ribbono Shel Olam, he says, God, I want to daven, I want to pray, but nobody ever taught me. So he takes out his flute that he usually uses, you know, as a shepherd boy, you know, to shepherd the flock. And he says to the Ribbono Shel Olam, I'm just going to play my flute. You take the pieces and the tones and the notes and you, God, construct them into tefillah. So that's one way of understanding the shofar. We say to the God, I'm so overwhelmed, I don't even know how to formulate logically my tefillos. I'm just in a state of awe. I'm going to blow the shofar. And God, you take the pieces of the shofar, the trua, and the tkiya, and the shvarim, and you put it all together and make a tefillah out of it. But Rashi has a different answer. And Rashi's answer is, how do I make the shofar into a tefillah? The answer is I recite Malchus, and then I blow the shofar. Those are the shofars of Malchus. And then I recite Zichronos, and those are the shofars of Zichronos. And finally shofars. Each one of these three has a different theme to it. And that theme will define the tefillah element of the shofar. So there really are three different themes of tefillah in shofar. Oh, I didn't realize what time it is. Okay, Rav Olsen, we'll stop here.
Thank you.
If you could open the door, we'll be able to hear Barker, hopefully.